Hello and welcome to the London Philharmonic Orchestra's February podcast. I'm Edward Seckerson. This month, all five concerts at the Royal Festival Hall are conducted by either the principal or principal guest conductor of the orchestra, and we'll be hearing from both about the works they've programmed. Vladimir Yurovsky also introduces the latest CD on the orchestra's own label, recent concert recordings of the First and Second Symphonies by Johannes Brahms. The orchestra's principal guest conductor, Yannick Nézet-Séguin, conducts two concerts of French music on the 10th and 13th of February. Bringing together works by Ravel, Poulenc, Debussy and Fauré, we'll be hearing familiar and less familiar works from composers who created a whole new way of painting with sound. From Ravel's Pavane and Debussy's La Mer to a composer I'm particularly fond of, Francis Poulenc, his concerto for two pianos and orchestra, and a glorious work, his Stabat Mater. Well, those dates have been in my diary for some time now, so don't forget that you can find out full details of all our concerts and listen to some of the music as well on our website, www.lpo.org.uk. As a French-Canadian, the French repertoire is music that Yannick Nézet-Séguin, not surprisingly, has a natural affinity for. If you heard his performance of Ravel's La Valse last season, I'm sure you'll have vivid memories of the seductive and volcanic sounds he drew from the orchestra, not least that amazing conclusion when the whole Viennese tradition crashes and burns. I started by asking him about his general approach to this repertoire.
The basis of the approach is actually because, if you look at this, the musical history of France, there's a period where France has not produced really major composers except maybe of Berlioz, and he was sort of alone. And then there were more, in the Romantic era, it was more a lyrical theater, opera, oriented composers. And then arrived Fauré opening everything to Ravel, Debussy, and then eventually Poulenc. So the classical period or Baroque period of French, you know, with Couperin, with Rameau, with Lully, if we go back, this is more where I feel in a way that Ravel and Debussy went back to, in terms of purity of lines, in terms of articulation. And that's why pieces like Le Tombeau de Couperin or pieces like even Ma Mère Loi, which are scored for smaller ensembles, or even the Poulenc concerto for two pianos, are tributes to a classical, Baroque classical era. So keys for French music is more purity. Because refinement, we have to refine every texture, I think, in music. But purity, clarity, that's more what we're searching. And within that purity and clarity, quality of sound. Quality, which means never aggressive. So that's a lot to work, but it doesn't work if you want something which ends up being too washed out or so refined, like we say, that we don't feel the colors. Yeah. So that's more my approach now for Ravel and Debussy.
So how do you communicate that to an orchestra?
Well, it's all about working with the counterpoint, in a way, of it, and working in identifying lines. Of course, I will always repeat things like more sul tasto, for example, for the strings, so that it gets never aggressive. But I'm, like we did for La Valse at the beginning of the season, it was also very much about making sure that the articulation was very, very clear. And this gives all the excitement.
Yes.
And once this articulation is in place, then it's refinement of sound, quality of sound, and then is the fantasy of that music.
There's a great misconception, isn't there, about, you know, when people talk about impressionism and,
yeah,
and Debussy, for example, that, you know, we're not talking about blurred lines.
No.
We're talking about exactly as you put it.
Actually, it has to be blurred because it's clear, you know, and the quality of impressionism. I mean, if I'm trying to paint like an impressionist and I try to just do a like this, of course it's ugly. The beauty of impressionism is that it's actually such a structured image, and then the lines are smoothed into an impression from a distance. But actually, if it had not started with a very structured painting and conception, then of course it wouldn't be absolutely uninteresting as a painting. So it's the same thing. Also, a misconception about French music is it has to be light. Yes, light meaning not heavy, not grounded with the feet, but harmonically. The basses, the number of times I'm asking basses and Shelley, yes, more of this, because it's all the keys in the harmony. That's why it's so beautiful. So we need to emphasize that. And it's very good, back to my classical aspect of it. I still believe strongly that for an orchestra to do French music is as good and as healthy for the work together, for the ensemble work, for the intonation, for the listening to each other, articulating together, phrasing together, as Haydn and Mozart are. So really, it's the more I do it, the more I'm convinced about that.
Favorite French composer, without a doubt, is Poulenc. It's probably the audacity that I love
yes.
so much, and that wonderful description of him, half monk, half delinquent, which
definitely.
I think is great. And I always remember another description of the choral works. It's like these cherubs are poking their tongues out at you, you know? I don't know if you've ever heard that.
No, actually. That's quite good,
quite
yeah.
It's quite a nice idea, these frescoes that you see.
Yes.
Religious frescoes.
And it does bring, again, the subject about what is religion to one composer, because obviously I feel it's very moving works whenever he approaches religious works, or the Dialogue des Carmélites, of course, which is so heartfelt. And yet, with a superficial ear, or just listening to bits and pieces of it, one might be even offended and shocked at how unspiritual it sounds, or very direct, or even rhythmically, it's almost like he wants some excerpts of that Stabat Mater, are not only aggressive, but sometimes they look almost like a dance or someone making fun of things, but it's all done with such sincerity. That's what I find very touching, and like you say, the audacity because he was completely assuming who he was as a composer. And no, it might not be the one who led historically to something really new in the history of French music, but after some years, is this really relevant anyway?
Yeah.
We need to appreciate how you can recognize Poulenc within a few bars or a few seconds, once you know a little bit of his style, to say, oh, that's him.
I do think Poulenc is very special and very universal.
Absolutely.
There's something in these pieces for everyone. Let's just touch on the piano, the concerto
two
pianos.
Yeah. Which I think might be, in some ways, his best work.
It's fascinating.
Instrumentally, at
least. It's the range of kind of, you know, from burlesque to
yes.
these very twilight
yes.
spiritual moments.
And classical. Because the second movement is like a Mozart piano concerto. It's always like the same sonata rondo form, and and yet he's integrating. I played that concerto actually as a pianist quite a few times with the orchestra of the Conservatoire in Montreal, and then a little bit later on. And now it will be my first time conducting it, actually. So for me, it will be interesting to see, because I've always been fascinated by the orchestra writing there, because it's very concise. It comes only with few chords, few things. And in this respect, it might be connected to the Ravel G major piano concerto in terms of orchestral colors, solos, and then tutti, which are very effective. Well, those two works, the Stabat Mater and the concerto, if anyone wants to be introduced to Poulenc in concert, I think they're the ideal ones. They show his most obvious two sides, the monk and the delinquent. One aspect of Poulenc's music is also is its apparent simplicity. And then we can even connect that to some aspect of Bruckner. In terms of the meter, for example, Poulenc is very square. Very often 4-4, you just go and you have sort of a bass, which is very regular as someone walking. In Poulenc, there's this aspect of, yes, metrical simplicity, which the listener can actually feel comfortable with and then enjoy the harmony. And it's all in the harmony that the tension comes from. It's absolutely not, and that was quite, in a way, not revolutionary, but out of the actual ways of thinking at that time. In France, obviously, but also, you know, Stravinsky was not doing this. You can say that a little bit maybe of Shostakovich later on, it doesn't come with the rhythmical aspect, it comes more for the harmony, and the rhythmical aspect is comforting more than anything. And it's that duality, which I think is really where Stabat Mater is the most special. But the most heartbreaking moments are really the ones where the soprano is just floating above the chorus and the orchestra.
On the 24th of February, Vladimir Yurovsky conducts a concert of three works by Shostakovich. The fledgling First Symphony, preceded by the short opera The Gamblers, and a suite of music from his opera The Nose, both works setting satirical texts by the Russian writer Nikolai Gogol. Shostakovich only wrote one act of The Gamblers, and it provides a compelling and shocking glance at human treachery, deceit and desperation.
Bravo! Я боюсь, чтобы он нас не застал здесь.
Ничего, Степан Иванович его удержит. Ступай, брат, тебя зовут.
This opera, The Gamblers, is dedicated to men playing cards for money and deceiving one another. So it's an opera. It's a play, predominantly, about crooks. And Shostakovich started writing it without having a ready-made libretto at hand. So he simply started setting to music every single word of Gogolin text. After about 40 minutes of music he composed, he realized that he he hasn't been through even half of Act One. And eventually he abandoned the idea. I also think there was a political reason for that, because he cannot have been completely oblivious of the fact that the music of the Gamblers was very suspiciously resemblant of his early experiments in the nose. And after all the criticisms Shostakovich had to endure in the late 30s, he would not have dared to present another Gogol opera. He knew it would be banned. And also, the time was not right for it. The war was raging, and nobody would ever allow an opera about card games and crooks being staged. To me, this is an unfinished masterpiece. I think if Shostakovich had finished it, it would have been his best opera, even better than Lady Macbeth and Tansk. And it becomes a kind of encyclopedia, kind of a Bible of Russian vices.
Он ничего не делает.
Czech music takes the limelight on the 20th of February. Janáček's earthy and majestic Taras Bulba and the Eternal Gospel are preceded by Josef Suk's mighty Second Symphony, Azrael. This magnificent work is at last achieving greater currency on the international scene, and it's very much a high point of Vladimir's current season. So, who was Azrael, and why does this symphony bear the name?
Azrael is the angel of death. Azrael is, in the Bible, the angel who is taking away the mortals. Azrael is a deeply personal and deeply tragic work, because Suk started writing it following the events of Dvořák's death. Dvořák, who was not only a mentor and the older friend to Suk, but also, incidentally, was his father-in-law. 6 months later, Dvořák's daughter, Suk's wife, unexpectedly dies, and Suk finishes the symphony already dedicated to the memory of both of them, Dvořák and his wife. So it's a really tormenting story, and such is the music. And I must say, this is the work where Suk finally succeeds in coming out of Dvořák's shadow and goes out into a much bigger world. To me, there are more allusions and parallels with the symphonies by Mahler in Azrael than with symphonies by Dvořák. Of course, you inevitably hear the Czech origins. The chromosomes of this music are deeply Eastern European, but the scope of ideas and the universal dimensions of the symphony, it's very long, make one think of Bruckner and Mahler. And that also made me think that the ideal companion to this piece would be Janáček's esoteric cantata, The Eternal Gospel, which is based on the text of the medieval mystic Joachim de Fiore, which is quite an unusual work for Janáček, who was, as we know, a deeply rooted in the native soil, but also very rationally thinking, very modern for his times man, that somebody like him would revert to such a strange, esoteric, apocalyptic text. To me, this is a work of, I would say, almost political importance, because the issues of war and peace and violence and rejecting the violence, and also the attempt, the desperate attempt to make people open their eyes and ears and be aware of what's going around them in the world, that's an ever-burning theme. And I think Janáček's take on the text is more of a universally humanitarian approach rather than a specifically Christian, esoteric, mystical. I find the Janáček's Eternal Gospel, as well as his Taras Bulba, which, by the way, is another setting of Gogol's story. So Gogol is running as a second hidden theme, which in a way is more than appropriate, because 2009 the world is celebrating Gogol's bicentenary. So we're slightly late with our contributions, but I think they're still quite significant. So I find the Janáček's life-affirming and humanist message in both Taras Bulba, which is a very tragic piece if you read the Gogol's story. But there is something extremely optimistic and life-affirming in this music, and I think it counterbalances the rest of the program, which is going to be very tragic.
Recordings. This month's new CD on the LPO's own label features Vladimir Yurovsky conducting Brahms's first and second symphonies, recorded at concerts in the Royal Festival Hall in 2008. Because these symphonies occupy such a prominent place in the core repertoire, we tend to forget how radical and innovative they are. So who better to round off this podcast with his thoughts on this release than the conductor himself? Thanks for listening.
Well, it took Brahms an incredibly long time to come to terms with his wish to compose symphonies. He was well in his 40s when he wrote Symphony No. 1. And considering that he didn't come late to composing music, it was a really long and painful process of coming out of the shadow of a great Beethoven and finding courage to say in his own words what has long been on his mind, but for what he considered himself not strong enough, not independent, not autonomous enough as a composer. So The composition of a symphony for Brahms meant going back into the pantheon of the great dead, Mozart and Beethoven and Schubert. And nowadays they became indispensable part of the mainstream repertory. And I think people in our camp, in the performers camp, sometimes tend to take them almost for granted. We sometimes think this is the most natural thing to hear or play a Brahms symphony, because it's such a gorgeous music. But we often forget what the composer had to go through before it came to the creation of this beautiful and seemingly easy works. So I personally took a long, long time in my career as a performing musician to prepare myself to the performing of the symphonies, and the preparation took I would say several decades, because if I consider that I started studying conducting at 17, I conducted my first Brahms symphony almost 20 years later. And I have this conviction, like with Mahler or Bruckner, that one should perform the symphonies in the order as they were written. So not doing 4 before 3, not doing 2 before 1. You can see on the cover of this CD that the performance of the symphony number 1 is taken from a concert which took place in May 2008. And the second symphony was performed in September, same year. So such a short distance between two performances also gives a hint at how short the distance was between the composition of the first and the second symphony. The difference is, of course, that the performance of the second symphony, which is captured on this disc, is my first attempt at the symphony, and so far the only one. I haven't done the symphony since after. While the first symphony, we had several attempts at with the orchestra together since 2007. We even went on a short tour with it, and then we came back, and this performance in May 2008 seemed a conclusion of what's probably to be the first chapter of our long-standing relationship with Brahms. Obviously the orchestra had played this piece many, many times before with many different conductors. I also have done Brahms 1 not that many times, but several times before having done it with the LPO, with other orchestras. Interestingly, not comparing myself with Brahms, but there is something very symptomatic about the painfully long process the composition of the first symphony was, and the painfully long process I experienced when preparing the performance of it, simply because there is something deeply complex and uneasy about this symphony, both stylistically and from the point of view of its emotional and spiritual content. While the second symphony, though I personally consider it a better, more mature work than the first, and also a deeper work in many instances, it has a natural flow to it, this irresistibly genuine feel to every change of harmony, every apparition of a new theme, which makes it extremely easy for the performer to find their way into the music. While the first symphony still remains a kind of a Ding an sich, a thing in itself, which it is a remaining riddle, it's an enigma. And it was very interesting for me last September when we did the first symphony at the Proms. So that was the first time we came back to it after that performance in May 2008, having done the second. How much the performance of the second had influenced my approach to the first. So next season we are planning to do 3, and then at the end of the season, symphony number 4. So I'm sure going back to 1 and 2 after that will be a different experience altogether.